I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The problem today with the United Nations' attempt to solve global problems can be summed up in two short sentences. The world has changed. The UN has not. It's still operating under the same set of rules devised after the Second World War. In the face of new threats and bloody civil disputes and unilateral attacks by superpowers, it's no longer enough for the UN to ponder its own Chapter 6, or its Charter of the Pacific Settlement of Disputes. There's a lot on the table this week as the UN tries to remake itself with the results of a brand new study. There's talk of attacking corruption at the UN, talk of redesigning the Security Council, and once again attempts to shift the balance of power. We want to talk this hour about peacekeeping. In the last 15 years in Bosnia, Somalia, Rwanda, now Darfur, once again in Rwanda, it's clear that something's broken. The UN is at least acknowledging that much. But here's the question. What will it take to make the blue helmets of the UN actually effective? Should the UN even be in the peacekeeping business? Look at Bosnia today. The EU's taking over peacekeeping duties from NATO there. Is that the model? And if there is any point talking about this, and rather, is there any point talking about this, if the US remains suspicious about working in any capacity within a UN peacekeeping model? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we will be talking with a number of people throughout this hour. I want to begin with General Romeo Dallaire. He was a force commander for the UN assistance mission in Rwanda. He is now a fellow at Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights. And he's joining me in the studio. Nice to have you back again.
Thank you very much.
Your role in Rwanda showed you and all of us some of the worst failings of the UN peacekeeping system. And I'm just wondering, in general, looking back, do you think this is a system that can be fixed?
It can be fixed, but we have to leap into a whole new conceptual base of conflict resolution, which is, in fact, a part of the research I'm ongoing and have been doing and will continue, of course. And what I mean by that is that the methodologies of, as you just said, 60 years ago, of classic war and classic peace and classic peacekeeping, Chapter 6 and so on, are simply not meeting the challenges of the ambiguity and the complexity of conflicts, particularly intrastate conflicts, but also conflicts created by these new threats such as terrorism. And in so much as the UN is attempting to maneuver with that, it's using old methods that simply cannot meet. I'll give you an example. We don't even have the right lexicon in the UN and, in fact, in international diplomacy to solve these problems. In the past, be involved with conflict, the instructions were fairly clear. You know, you will attack or defend, or you will withdraw, or you'll win the war. I mean, It's all simple, simplistic in that sense. But today, you don't hear that anymore. I mean, my mission was to establish an atmosphere of security. Now, the diplomats will create that, the politicians, but there's no definition behind it. You know, what does create an atmosphere of security? And what's an atmosphere? What's create? And so we entered an era where we're fiddling with words and mandates and ideas, but they have not been thought through in a conceptual, in a doctrinal fashion.
Let's just try a simple example based on your own experience. In those early months in 1994, those 3 months when you were phoning New York two, three times a day saying, give me some direction, give me some troops, this is going to go very bad. They ignored you, they ignored you, they ignored you. Mm-hmm. At that time, I think you wrote in your book, a couple of thousand troops might have made the difference in saving hundreds of thousands of people in Rwanda. Am I right
on
that?
Absolutely right.
And so if we were to wind the clock back and make that system a little bit more efficient, I mean, I look at your perspective and I see the problem in New York, where diplomats simply don't have to pull their chairs up to the table and come to a decision. It was delay that killed all those people in Rwanda.
Well, and it was also, if one must remember, that what's sitting around the decision tables, and in particular the Security Council, are nothing more than voices of the sovereign states' capitals. And as such, the sovereign states made it very clear that after Mogadishu at the time and the American pullout because of the 18 soldiers who were killed, that nobody was interested in risking casualties because it was not defendable. And in fact, genocide, even genocide was not defendable in nations where the country that's being overrun by genocide is of absolutely no strategic value. And so the domination of self-interest still exists. And that's certainly the impression you got from the American involvement in Iraq. Was it a humanitarian? Was it a human dimension for Iraqis? Or was it a self-interest one? And what we've seen in the 90s is more and more single nation-led coalitions operating outside of the UN, be it the Brits outside of the UN in Sierra Leone, the French outside of the UN in Côte d'Ivoire for a while. And in so doing, they're giving their own troops and their diplomats the words and the actions and the mandates and the room to maneuver. But these same countries in the Security Council don't want to do it, and they don't give it. And in fact, what we've done is through the 90s, because of self-interest, that is to say, if a country is not worth it right. to go, then what we've done is contracted out Blue Beret cannon fodder to countries who have absolutely no skills, no depth, no equipment to be able to respond to these complex missions.
I want to bring another voice in here. Nick Birnbach is joining us now on the line from UN headquarters in New York. He's media affairs officer for the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. Hi, Nick.
Hey, how you doing, Dick?
Fine, thanks. A More Secure World, Our Shared Responsibility. That's the title of what is being looked at here. I understand that the report is coming out today, and we're all basically working with reports of what is in it. I should also point out that you've got some considerable experience yourself working as a peacekeeper. So you know whereof you speak when we're talking about what can be changed. Can anything be fixed here?
I think so. And, you know, I think that General Dallaire has pointed out, of course, many of the severe challenges that we have to confront. But I also would point out that the United Nations, and particularly the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, has in fact changed a great deal since the era of the missions in Rwanda and Somalia and Bosnia-Herzegovina. That undertook a large reform process ourselves in the Department of Peacekeeping Operation, which we refer to as the PEMI process,
right.
About 5 years ago. And as a result of that, we really have changed the way we've done business. We've increased in size here at headquarters about sixfold. We now have what's called the strategic deployment stocks that allow us to deploy the equipment that missions need a lot faster. We can get money to do stuff in what's called pre-mandate commitment authority a lot quicker. And perhaps more importantly, we also have looked at more flexible arrangements in dealing with these problems with regard to bringing in regional organizations and other partners like the European Union and the DRC and the French in Côte d'Ivoire. So, you know, I think that we are changing. We already are changing, and we look forward to the results of the high-level panel in helping us to continue that process.
All right, we're going to go a little bit further into this, into the I want to take my first call from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Phil is joining us on the line from there. Hi, Phil.
Well, actually, it's Bill. But
Bill,
thank
I'm sorry.
You very much for taking my call.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Go ahead.
I guess I wanted to point out that perhaps there are other alternatives to peacekeeping that the United Nations and other bureaucracies around the world haven't considered. Privatizing many security functions has been very successful in places like Iraq. I'm the executive vice president for a company called Blackwater USA. We currently provide the security services for the U.S. ambassador in Iraq.
And you lost four men in Fallujah some considerable months ago, am I right? Same company?
Yes, we did.
And you're saying that private security people, firms like Blackwater, might be or would be better than gathering people together from different countries, putting blue helmets on them and calling them peacekeepers?
Well, quite frankly, that's exactly what many of these private firms would do. The private firms are comprised almost exclusively of ex-retired military servicemen who have informal networks that the bureaucracies would be hard-pressed to match. The gentleman from the United Nations had talked about wishing to build coalitions and relationships with foreign countries to place multinational peacekeeping forces in place to do good things in places like the Darfur region and perhaps in the Congo or Rwanda here shortly. Many of those networks and relationships already exist amongst these private firms and could be leveraged much, much quicker than the United Nations probably would ever be able to accomplish the same task.
Bill, I want you to stay on the line. I want to bring Nick Byrne back in, just on the principle of doing it privately rather than trying to do it through the convoluted diplomatic channels of the UN. Nick,
I think that there's a couple of things here. First of all, what the United Nations brings to the table when it confronts a problem like this is a unique legitimacy that a private military contractor, which is ultimately responsible to a bottom line, doesn't. We also have, decades of fairly hard-won experience and, I would argue, a degree of expertise and unique capabilities that we've built up. Secondly, in the flexible arrangements that I mentioned earlier, in bringing in, for example, regional organizations, we do understand now what we can do and what we can't do. And let me just give you a quick example. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, when it looked like there was an imminent genocide in the Ituri region in a town called Bunia, we, the United Nations, authorized the European Union-led mission Operation Artemis to come in, which they did very quickly to stabilize the situation. That's the type of flexible arrangement that we're looking at now, which would enable us to deal with this problem without necessarily having to go to private companies.
And Bill, back to you. When you have people who come in with the flag on their shoulder of different countries in Europe or Asia representing some kind of international consensus in New York, are you saying that from your perspective at Blackwater, that doesn't matter anymore?
No, not at all. And I would agree with almost everything that Nick said. And I would say that any private security company that would be employed would have to be employed under the auspices and with the direction and control and participation of a group like the United Nations. I'm just saying that the next point that Nick made was, that a private company is beholden to a bottom line, which I absolutely would agree with, but I would look at that as a positive. A military operation that is not in some ways looking at the cost of those operations, is probably destined for cost overruns and a burgeoning budget, whereas if we have to think about the dollars that go out the door, we're likely to accomplish the mission in a more cost-efficient manner.
All right. Bill, I'm going to thank you for your call, and we will continue on with this. We have to take a short break in a couple of minutes. General Dallaire, some thoughts from you on the idea of using private contractors when we come back. I'm going to say goodbye to Nick Byrnback at this point because he's off to do something else. Nick, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dick.
Nick's Media Affairs Officer for the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. And a reminder to our listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255. This is the day when a very wide-ranging study is being made public at the United Nations. And yes, indeed, they're talking about the Security Council and some of the big, broad brush shape of the organization. What we want to focus on is peacekeeping, because when we are talking about the involvement of the UN, whether we're talking about Iraq or an emergency meeting that is taking place today, looking at the latest from Congo and Rwanda, it all comes down to peacekeeping and whether or not this organization even can be reorganized in a way which will save lives and provide the kind of protection that people in the world want. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Who keeps the peace? Who ought to keep the peace? Bill from Blackwater says maybe this whole notion of taking people from around the globe, putting a blue helmet on them, calling them UN peacekeepers, and sending them between warring parties is not the way to go. Maybe you should take advantage of the expertise of the people who have been working in as soldiers and now hire themselves out as private contractors for firms like Blackwater. General Romeo Dallaire is with me in the studio. He is the author of Shake Hands with the Devil, The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. It tells the story of his time as force commander in Rwanda. What do you think?
I think it's one of the most dangerous routes that we can consider. in going down this privatization process of security. And I'm wondering whether or not it's, in its extreme, it's legalizing mercenaries. But in moving back from that, it is a demonstration of nations copping out from taking the responsibility of providing from sovereign states to other sovereign states the resources they need to permit them to establish security and peace in their countries.
Okay, but let me just stop you for half a second here, because soldiers from some Asian countries like Bangladesh have been criticized for coming in without the experience, without the uniforms and the weapons to do the job of peacekeeping. You had this problem in Rwanda. These Blackwater boys, if we can call them that, are supposed to be pretty experienced at this sort of thing. Bill's making the point that they have these informal networks that allow them to operate in many different parts of the world. What would be the problem? Imagine yourself back in command again. What would be the problem having that kind of experience under your command?
Well, ultimately, what is their loyalty? Ultimately, what is their true loyalty to the mission when the chips are down and it's them, their lives, and the lives of others that they're protecting? And in my estimation, you need the sovereign state responsibility, or that still sense of duty that comes from being within a structured group of a nation and what it carries with it, to be able to use forces that will commit themselves to the mission ultimately, and not privatizations who, when the chips are down, will they risk as much their lives to achieve the mission, or will they say, hey, I've got a business here, or I want to keep on working, and so I'm going to pull back. Now, the fact that we're using very ineffective troops is because the regional system that, in fact, Boutros Ghali talked about in 92 has not come to the fore. The African Union is right now being set up to failure in Darfur, not only because of the mandate, because of the skill sets and the abilities to sustain their operations and to be able to qualified to do it. And so regional capabilities, yes, but they still need out-of-region people to give them the strength and build up those skills. And what we're trying to do is say that the white countries, developed countries, don't want to get in there because we don't want the casualties. We'll contract it out to underdeveloped countries because they need the money and they're ineffective. And by the by, if that doesn't work too well, well, we'll contract it out to guys who are in the business because for them it's a money-making organization. And it's a good, reasonable way of life. But in the end, are we achieving the mission? And I believe that we're not.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join us. I want to bring Anthony Arend into the conversation now. He's joining us from a studio at Georgetown University, where he is professor and director of the Institute for Law and Politics there. Anthony, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Can I ask you to start with a bit of history here? Was there a time that we can look back to since the Charter of the UN was first written when the peacekeeping problems that we're talking about today jumped to the forefront?
Well, I think the interesting thing about peacekeeping is that it was not envisioned in the United Nations Charter. When the Charter was adopted in 1945, essentially there was a choice between peaceful settlement of international disputes. You mentioned Chapter 6 of the UN Charter, which deals with that, and enforcement actions under Chapter 7. The notion was states were to settle their disputes peacefully, and if that didn't work, if a state committed an act of aggression, or if there were a threat to the peace or a breach of the peace, the Security Council would then authorize an enforcement action against that state which had committed that offense. Now, what happened was, during the Cold War, the United Nations was really impotent. It wasn't able to do anything to fight aggression or fight threats to the peace. And so peacekeeping evolved as an innovation, as something that could be done after the conflict was essentially over, when both sides realized that they wanted the conflict to stop. What the United Nations was able to do was interpose neutral forces, individuals who could go between the parties, who could supervise a ceasefire, facilitate a troop withdrawal, and hopefully prevent the conflict from breaking out once again into a hot conflict.
We go back to places like Suez and Cyprus for examples of where this worked?
Precisely. The Suez crisis in 1956 was perhaps the first occasion in the UN period when peacekeeping was used, and then Cyprus, as you mentioned, in 1964. Now, in these circumstances, it tended to work very well. You tended to be able to find neutral forces that you could put in. You really didn't require the kind of muscle that we think of today. You were keeping the parties apart once the parties had agreed that they wanted to be kept apart. Now, what happened was when the first Gulf War occurred in 1991, well, really in 1990, when Iraq invaded Kuwait, the United Nations system suddenly started to work differently. With the Cold War over, the Security Council was able to act under Chapter 7. It was actually able to say that there has, in fact, been a breach of the peace, and we're going to authorize the use of military force. And you saw a UN-authorized enforcement action taking place. Really, the first time in history. In Korea, something similar happened, but that was really a fluke. And what that meant was the United Nations, and indeed the major powers in the United Nations, felt empowered. They said, now that the Cold War has ended, we can become more muscular. We can engage in more traditional enforcement actions. And so we started seeing the UN getting involved in places like you mentioned, such as Bosnia, Somalia, and others. But the problem was this. In many of those cases, the UN wasn't really sure what its role was. In some instances, such as Somalia, the UN went in initially as a peacekeeper to keep the parties apart, to keep the factions apart, facilitate production of humanitarian assistance and the like. But as the conflict grew more and more tense, the UN moved in the direction of an enforcement action. And so you had the same organization on the ground at once trying to be a neutral peacekeeper and yet at the same time trying to engage in enforcement actions. And this was, you mentioned the phrase muddling. This in a sense was a confusion of the purpose of the organization, or at least the goals of the organization in that conflict.
And this is General Dallet. This is exactly what you faced in Rwanda. Do we shoot or do we stand between these civil warring parties?
Well, in fact, the interpretation of the mandates and the limitations thereof due to Chapter 6 made it impossible for us to take any preemptive action, even though the situation required it, and we could have quite easily, would have a slight modification of the mandate, have done that and prevented the whole thing from exploding. And yet the Security Council didn't want to go that route. And of course, there was everyone being quite gun-shy about Mogadishu that didn't help the situation at that time.
Let's go to a call from Norfolk, Virginia. Steve's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Steve.
Yes, hello. How are you doing?
Fine. What are you thinking?
Two quick comments. First comment with regards to the proposal for using security contractors for peacekeeping operations. I couldn't agree more with the last couple speakers with how this would not be a valuable option. Ultimately, what you're relying upon is the representation of the UN and the neutrality of the nation states that are composed of the peacekeeping operation.
Right.
If it degrades down to a bunch of corporate security forces being hired to fill the gap, then there's no way to really continue the respectability or the viability of the UN presence.
Okay, your second point, Steve?
The second point is with regards to the UN peacekeeping forces, your last speaker from Georgetown was absolutely correct. The peacekeeping is an evolutionary process. Currently, the UN looks at the mandates more along the line of peace enforcement or peacemaking, which are very new concepts to the UN. And as a matter of fact, it's just within the last 8 years or so that the UN has actually started to take action where they see the total concept of not only humanitarian but also law enforcement rolling into a peacekeeping operation, which was something that was a dismal failure in Bosnia because there was no way to enforce law. There was no way to keep the peace because you basically had soldiers trying to act as policemen, and this is one of the problems that they had at the time. And I'll go offline for comment from your speakers.
Thanks, Steve.
And rightly so, but I think it is now in the era where I mentioned of a lexicon, of a new conceptual base of humanitarian, military, political, police, to integrate their disciplines instead of continuing the stovepiping and cooperation that's going. So you need a new generation of leaders to be able to be multidisciplined in doing it. And in the same vein, I think that peacekeeping is no more term of the era. And in fact, conflict resolution is far more attuned to what we should expect from the UN than actually trying to fiddle around the concepts that were there with peacekeeping and the old methodologies.
To Durham, North Carolina next, and Jim's on the line from there. Jim.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Well, I agree with the general. I was a peacekeeper. I served under the French Lunaire. I was actually an American Armed Forces. I was a sergeant, and I was attached to a French unit, and we were in great. We saw so much carnage, and we were pulled back.
Was this Srebrenica area? Is that what you're talking about,
yes,
Jim?
Yes. We were pulled back, and we were not given the – we were willing to fight, but we were pulled back because too many U.N. rules disapprove or none let us engage. And we saw the snipers, and we saw tanks, we saw everything, you know, and we were willing to attack, but we were pulled back due to U.N. our commanders wanted to attack, but the U.N. told us no.
Jim, I'm going to kick this back to my guest in half a sec, but just one more question from you. Just reflecting back on that time, were you thinking at the time, you know, to heck with the whole blue helmet thing, let me be here as an American, let me be here as a French fighter, let's not worry about trying to come to some kind of global consensus, let's stop these people from killing each other?
Yes, that's our amendment. With that, when we went brief, our briefing was to actually make them stop fighting. And that's, as a ground troop, our point of view was yes, but when we got there, our weapons were removed, and we were just given a bulletproof and a bulletproof vest and a helmet. And in some areas, we were given our weapons. At the long run, our weapons were given back.
Anthony Arend, you know that in the years since the U.S. moved into Iraq, there's been lots of talk about just using single country intervention like this. Does that work? General Dallaire was talking earlier about the French in Cote d'Ivoire. I mean, that's part of the debate here. Is there any point trying to do this on some kind of multilateral basis based on the strange, complex nature of conflict that we're looking at today?
Well, I think a lot of it does need to be done multilaterally. And at the very least, it needs a multilateral imprimatur. Now, some of it depends on the types of conflicts you're talking about. If you're talking about the first Gulf War, for example, you're clearly going to need to have a major coalition led by states such as the United States and Great Britain. You're going to need that kind of firepower in order to accomplish your purpose. However, it's exceptionally important that there is a UN Security Council authorization for those circumstances. In cases such as Cote d'Ivoire, in cases such as Sierra Leone, in other circumstances, where you can get the Security Council to authorize that use of force, that adds the level of legitimacy which I think is absolutely necessary. I mean, if we were to contrast, for example, the first Gulf War and the most recent war in Iraq, look at the level of international commitment during the first Gulf War. There was a Security Council authorization. There was a larger coalition. Not every state was involved. Certainly the United States was the major power involved, yet it was supported internationally. It had international legitimacy. The more recent Iraq war was not authorized by the Security Council. It did not have the level of international legitimacy that it needed. And I think, to me, that's a very, very important lesson. You may choose to have one particular state or several states who are militarily powerful lead the operation, but at the very least, you need multilateral authorization. You need the support of the Security Council in order for it to be an action of the international community rather than an action of an individual state.
You're listening to The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. It is in many ways a question of moral authority and whether or not the UN has that kind of moral authority. I think a lot of people in this country, General Dallaire, would question whether or not the UN still has the moral authority it might have had back in the 40s and the 50s.
Well, I think that's a very pertinent observation. And I think a lot of the attrition of the UN in fact, remaining that impartial and transparent organization and having the skills or evolving with the skills to respond to the spectrum now of conflict that we have, which was identified, is the fact that the middle powers, to Germany and Japan and Canada and Scandinavians and even Brazil, if you want to add Brazil in there, have not been pulling their weight. They have, in fact, abdicated from being a major thrust, even a coalition, in providing resources,
innovative ideas and options to the big powers in order to give them more room to maneuver instead of tripping over each other like Iraq was.
So are you saying that the real future in UN peacekeeping comes from the middle powers? It doesn't come from the Americans or the Russians or the Chinese?
Their positions are relatively known and established. The renaissance of the UN will come from the middle powers committing themselves extensively to conflict resolution through the UN and provide the maneuverability that the big powers need before they get committed into areas where they ultimately get attrited and then the whole process is thrown down. So as an example, Iraq, okay, we didn't agree about going in, but you're going in. Ultimately, the Iraqis will suffer one way or another. Where we failed as middle powers, and some of us tried to argue for it, is that we should have argued with the Americans to say, you can get us to Baghdad. You have that capability, and I agree with them leading that dimension. Yeah. However, don't go in.
Let us go in.
Let the middle powers, who don't have the stigma of a big power, nor are overtly self-interest. And that would have been the option that would have made the success, I believe, or at least had a better chance of success, than keeping the same forces fighting their way through those towns.
And Anthony, what would Donald Rumsfeld say to a suggestion like that? I can hear him sort of snorting in derision.
I think you're right. I mean, my suspicion would be that what Rumsfeld would say is that the United States needs to take the lead, and the United States needs to act in its own national security interests, and it needs to work with powers that it can depend upon. Now, I don't agree with that argument, but my suspicion is he would say that he couldn't, meaning the United States couldn't, depend upon these middle powers. We can depend upon the British, let's say. Mm-hmm. But now I think General Dallaire is absolutely correct. If Iraq would have been done very differently, let's say, irrespective of whether the invasion itself was permissible or not, it happened. If at that point in time a UN transition authority would have been established and the middle powers would have been brought in, I think you would not have seen as much of an insurgency as we've seen. I think you would have not have seen as much of a lack of legitimacy that you've seen. That's precisely where you'd want to bring in the middle powers. But the irony is,
I got to stop you there because we're going to come to a break, but we're going to continue this. And the question is, so what we're talking about is the creation of a new kind of UN peacekeeping force, perhaps coming from a middle power level rather than the large powers. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour, a conversation about changes that are being proposed at the UN. We are concentrating our attention on peacekeeping, certainly one of the most controversial areas. General Romeo Dallaire is with me in the studio. He's currently a fellow at Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy, but was force commander for the UN Assistance Mission in Rwanda and author of a book called Shake Hands with the Devil. Anthony Arend is joining us from Georgetown University, where he's a professor and director of the Institute for Law and Politics there, author of a book on legal rules in international society. Anthony, I do want to just have you conclude the point that you were making about these middle powers, because I'm still not persuaded here. If you were to be able to, if you made the point to the Pentagon that you had all this expertise that the Swedes brought to the table and that the Canadians had spent the last 3 years working specifically on communications and that the Brazilians were particularly good when it came to urban conflict and that they were all used to working together, could you even then make the case to the Joint Chiefs?
Well, I think you need to. Now, what I was about to say was that in order for the middle powers to work, you need the great powers, meaning the United States, the British, and so on, to support that. So perhaps the way to do it is to go to the Pentagon and say, look, this will be more efficient, it will work better, and you, the Pentagon, the United States, can take the lead in organizing a structure for this in the future. So we'd play a role. Mm-hmm. We could help control the way it would play itself out, but the middle powers would still be doing the stuff on the ground. So maybe that would be a way to co-opt the Pentagon.
1-800-423-8255. Nashville, Tennessee. Ray's joining us from there. Hi, Ray.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Well, I agree completely about the legitimacy that the world needs to have in something like this, when America, which is so powerful, can just do anything it wants. And I was very disappointed, of course, that Bush went to the UN and they said no, and he said, well, we're going to do it anyway. What I wanted to ask was, I was encouraged by the NATO movement against Milosevic, where we seem to go in and say, this guy's got to go. Mm-hmm. Does everybody agree? And it seemed to go well. What was the difference there?
And why not use NATO as a model, General?
Well, I think that NATO is a heavy, overburdened, and structurally, in regards to conflict resolution, ineffective body.
Holy smokes, the UN doesn't look very good by comparison, though,
yeah,
does it?
Yeah, but I agree with that. But I don't believe that the NATO structure is what you absolutely require to meet these. It's expensive, and it's big, and it's heavy, and often can be very inflexible. What you do need is regional capabilities to support in regards to these operations. So build up the European Union capability, mm-hmm. Build up the African Union capability, but provide it also with outside assets to give it also the legitimacy. So it's like you send in the Canadians, with the African Union as an example, or other such nations. What I don't agree with in regards to the use of a body like NATO is that it's fundamentally structured for war, and it's looking for a job. And I don't believe that the reforms within the whole concept of use of force within NATO is going to have the flexibility and, in fact, the transparency that still UN forces can have, because there's still very strong dimensions of American enormous influence in NATO and pulling very much the strings thereof.
Okay, but one way of getting around that, and Anthony, maybe you can jump in on this, is taking that notion of the regional model to its extreme, where the African Union looks after matters in Africa, where the EU looks after conflicts in Europe, you've got ASEAN looking after South Asia, and so on down the list, and you don't really need to go all the way back to New York. At least then you're bringing some expertise to bear. Would that work?
I think that could be really problematic. Interestingly enough, that was what Winston Churchill wanted to do in the post-World War II era. He actually thought we needed to create a series of regional councils that would have primary role in maintaining international peace and security. And strangely, Churchill lost that debate. They decided that it must be under a centralized organization. You could use regional organizations, but they should always be working at the authorization of the United Nations. The problem is, if you allow regional organizations to go on completely on their own, you really could degenerate into a very bad international system, have competing blocks that would really be destructive of world peace rather than supporting it.
I absolutely, totally agree. The UN still is the only ultimate transparent and impartial body that gives legitimacy to these very complex problems within states and where we're fiddling with sovereignty. But the building up of the regional capabilities does not make them an independent operation, like we've now pushed the African Union to be, to the extent that they say that they can handle Darfur when we know they can't. Regional capabilities must need out-of-regional assets to continue to keep that marriage and that exchange going, and certainly for a period of time to give it the backbone of not only equipment, but doctrine and training and
the money.
Well, and the resources, absolutely. And that, again, is where you will have more transparency from middle powers going in there than seeing the Americans, the Brits, and the French handling that and bringing up all the inside those regions conflicts that were there from the colonial era and from this concept of, building regions of influence.
All right, to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Dave's joining us. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
What do you think?
I'm a Green Beret, and I've worked with the UN and with indigenous forces and also with contractors like Blackwater a lot. And I know the conversation's kind of moved on from the point I wanted to make, but I heard the general say that he didn't believe the contractors would fight as well as people wearing blue helmets.
I think his point was, where is their loyalty? Is it to their paycheck, or is it to something above that? I'm paraphrasing it, to their mission. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, my experience with these guys is they're men just like me. They've done the job for 20 years, moved on to a different company, but they're still loyal to the mission. They're still loyal to their commanders, and they'll fight with more flexibility and expertise and willpower than anyone in a blue helmet will do. If you take a private in the 82nd, put him in a peacekeeping situation, you know, a private from any army around the world, they're going to be scared, they're going to be unflexible.
Right. Dave, I don't want you to go anywhere. I want the general to answer some of your concerns. But I only want to add that in my own work in places like this, people like yourself have been very critical of, for example, the Ukrainian blue-helmeted soldiers because they were there to make money that they couldn't make at home. The Bangladeshi soldiers, the same thing. It was a money-making thing. They weren't there to help the people as much as they were to make cash. So what's the difference between those guys and the private contractors?
Well, I think two things. The first thing is the fact that the rules of engagement on Blue Berets are totally different than the rules of engagement on these
private contractors.
Yeah. And ultimately, the private contractors operate within a contractual structure and not from a consensus of mandate that comes out of the UN. And so that's why I speak of a new conceptual base to conflict resolution that is required behind the system. And secondly, there are countries that are still evolving in their democracies, in their belief in human rights, and in fact in their capabilities of in the field. And so do we abdicate all that? Do we throw it all out and say that's not working? Or do we work in a process that in fact is going to mature it? Just like many of us thought that we should create centers in, let's say, a region like Africa and assist them in building up their capabilities.
Okay, but what I want you to do, General, is make the case to Dave. Dave is a soldier with lots of experience. You're a commander with lots of experience. Mm-hmm. If you got to rewrite the rules in the way that we're sort of imagining they might be rewritten, if the UN peacekeeping system could be brought into the 21st century, could you make a case to him that he'd be better off fighting as an American soldier with a blue helmet on?
Let me state it quite clearly that I don't believe the Americans should ever have a blue helmet on. They are a world power. That is not their job to police the world.
Okay.
And in fact, I go through all the staff colleges and I tell them the last people I want on a UN mission with me are the Americans. I need them in overwatch. I need them to be able to intervene with all the power that they have. The blue helmet exercise is an exercise in nations who can, in fact, operate outside of this grand strategic position that the big powers like the French and the Brits and the Americans have. And in so doing, much of the restrictions that you will find on middle powers and developing nations in doing the job properly, however, come from the big nations. And the big nations, when they send their own troops, do not restrict their troops to that. And so there's got to be a maneuvering, a molding of great capability and medium capability to provide the assets and the flexibility in the field.
You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Back to Dave in Raleigh. What do you think?
Well, so he's saying that that the restrictions that the UN puts on the blue helmet actually helps create a peacekeeping environment? Am I reading him right?
No, absolutely not. In fact, the mandate, just like the one I had, restricts us from being able to do it. And the restrictions come from the Security Council that are dominated by the three powers. And so in one hand, the three powers don't give us the assets to do the job as blue helmets. However, when they go in, they provide whatever required mandates they need for their troops to accomplish the mission. And more often than not, it's too late because the crisis has already stopped.
So started. If the big powers then freed up UN peacekeepers to act with the same sort of flexibility on the ground that they would use when they were there, then you're saying it becomes more effective.
Well, it will be, in as much as also they have the capabilities of doing it. And the aim of the exercise in the blue helmets, as we call them, whatever we'll call them in the future,
yeah,
is far more in the courage of the powers to send in preventive measures. And that in crises, the UN does not have the immediate capability, which is one of the elements where the sovereign states don't want to give it that capability. But if we had a crisis response capability, sovereign states giving a bit of sovereignty even to guarantee troops to meet the crisis, and if that capability doesn't work, then you bring in the big powers, then we have a stepped process of escalating of use of force. Right now what you have is either you're standing there with your rifle and nothing, mm-hmm, or you bring in overwhelming force. And to me, that is lacking the whole flexibility of the spectrum of conflicts that we're facing today.
All right, Dave, I thank you for your call. Anthony, I want to come back to you if I can. And that is that it doesn't really matter which way we look at this prism, that giving extra flexibility and strength and local control to the blue helmet people, those folks who would be representing middle powers rather than the large powers, would still mean having the large powers give up a little bit of something. And I'm wondering whether or not the willingness, you think that they could be persuaded to do that?
I think they need to be persuaded. And I agree absolutely with what General Dallaire said. I think the great powers need to take the leadership role in setting the goals for peacekeeping, to establishing a process that will work. And up until now, I think the United States in particular has been remiss in taking this leadership role at the United Nations. What we need to do is think of ourselves, if you will, in a prime minister type role. We need to build a consensus. We need to work on goals. We need to try to set the kinds of guidance that the organization needs, not try to do it ourselves, but work through this organization. I use the example of a prime minister, much as a prime minister would in a parliament. Build coalitions, build consensus, and give direction and give financial support and leadership and allow the middle powers to do what they do best, put on the blue helmets.
And I think that the United States in particular is remiss in not kicking in the butt the middle powers to fess up to the responsibilities that they have and provide the assets and the capabilities to permit the three big powers to have the flexibility in operating. And that is an irresponsible position by the middle powers, who are sort of standing on the sidelines, joining or not joining, depending on what they feel, and seeing that complex role of conflict resolution being sent out to third world powers.
Even if this means President Bush going to Prime Minister Martin in Canada and saying, buy yourself some helicopters that actually fly.
At least that. At least that.
All right, this is a conversation we'll have again, no doubt. General Dallaire, I want to thank you so much for coming
in again.
Nice to have you here. General Romeo Dallaire, Force Commander for the UN Assistance Mission in Rwanda. And Anthony Arend, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you.
Anthony is Director of the Institute for Law and Politics at Georgetown University. Earlier in the program, a chance to talk with Nick Birnbach, spokesman for the UN Department of Peacekeeping Operations. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.